Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR, Sirius XM Channel 141, 96.3 HD2 and 98.3 FM. This is the Insight segment. I'm Harold Fisher. There was heartbreak in Montgomery County last week as the remnants of Hurricane Ida swept through our region, creating flooding and taking the life of a young man in Rockville. It was just one of the critical issues coming out of the county over the past several weeks. And joining us to talk about all pressing issues in the county is County Executive Mark Eldridge. If you have a comment or a question, give us a call. Lines are open. He's answering your questions and ours tonight. Lines are open at 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. You can tweet us at HFisherWHUR, or you can find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Mr. County Executive, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you. How you doing?
I'm doing all right. Thank you for asking, and I hope you had a peaceful Labor Day.
I did not.
Yeah.
Well, I was in meetings even on that day.
Yes. Yeah. Well, you know, that's kind of what you signed up for when you're a county executive. I certainly understand that. Let us get to the issue that I just mentioned. There was loss of life because of the remnants of Hurricane Andrew at the apartment complex that flooded the Rock Creek Woods apartments last week. And one of the things that you said after that incident was you wanted to know why those apartments flooded. Have you found out what happened?
Near as we can tell, and I'm not the forensic expert, but there is a pipe that goes underneath that big, long parking lot where the apartments were. And the apartments are below this driveway area and this parking area. And on the other side of the pipe, there's a stream that comes down through Rockville. And apparently, and this was a big pipe, the entrance to it was, you know, a few feet high, and it looks to be about 8 to 10 feet long, just to give you a perspective. When they got hit with, we were told, about 2.5 inches of water in an astoundingly short period of time. And the torrent that went down that little stream valley completely filled the entrance to the outlet. It rose about 4 feet or 5 feet to get up to the grass level, and then rose another 2 feet. You could see debris pushed up against the chain link fence. So it rose well above the level of the creek, flooded across the driveway, down the hill, and in a flash at about 3:30 or 3 o'clock in the morning, filled this area, which is kind of a bowl. You think of the house, the apartment units are down at the bottom with no way out. And, of course, normally that's not a problem. It was a big problem that day. It filled that bowl in the middle of the night, and it looked as, you know, in some apartments the water could have been as high, you know, on the low side to 4 feet, and on the high side, close to 6 or 7 feet. It was like nothing I've ever seen.
That, again, certainly unfortunate. We've seen reports, of course, that as many as 150 people were displaced, right, and that building was condemned. What's going to happen to the building? And as far as you know, what is the status of those people who have been displaced?
So we were able to relocate everybody pretty quickly. I think by the end of the next day, we had relocated pretty much everyone into housing. I know the landlord was contributing to that. And we were, there's one of the buildings that was condemned. It's the basement's going to have to be fixed where all the utilities were, and you know, furnaces and things like that. They've got a bit of work to do before it gets recovered. The other buildings, they're going to have to do first floor cleaning and get all the water out, and, you know, they'd have to do something with the walls because they got soaked as well. So they've got some work to do before they can actually bring occupants back. But the other units, the other buildings will come back quicker. The first buildings, no doubt, going to take a little bit longer.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We are talking all things Montgomery County tonight with County Executive Mark Eldridge. If you have a comment, if you have a question for the County Executive, lines are open. Of course, we will be taking phone calls all evening up until, of course, 8 o'clock. Let's talk about the return to school. Students returned last year across the state, across the country. The big concern is COVID safety. How would you evaluate the process so far? How are things going from your perspective?
Look, I think mostly it's going pretty well. We've had some bumps regarding how testing and decisions to quarantine are being done. But we think that's what I spent Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday talking about, was trying to figure out what we can do quickly. We've located rapid test kits, and so we're going to have rapid test kits available to the schools, so they'll be able to test kids if they have symptoms. And you got to remember, the symptoms for COVID are like anything you could possibly have other than feeling good. So almost anything falls into the symptom category. So they'll be able to test these students pretty quickly with the rapid test. And when they do that, they'll know whether or not anybody has to quarantine or whether that person has to quarantine if it's positive. And then they have to determine who that student was actually in close contact with. This will all go better with testing. And like I said, we should have tests out to the schools very quickly. So that should resolve that bigger issue. We're hoping that they get an approval for the vaccine for the 5 to 12-year-old groups, so that these kids can get vaccinated, as well as, you know, our high school and middle school kids who are largely vaccinated. When you look at our numbers and you think about what percentage of the student body or what percentage of the county is largely vaccinated, you can't get those numbers unless you've got a bunch of kids in this group as well vaccinated. So I'm feeling like we'll be able to make progress on this, and we just hope that we don't get visited by more and worse variants, which obviously is the threat that we all face.
Talk to me about this opt-in, opt-out process. Did you have a lot of parents who were opting out of having their children tested?
The school opted for an opt-in process, and we've had a conversation about that, about whether we want to stick with opt-in. The state has conditioned our use of some of their programs to using an opt-in system. I think an opt-in system is a mistake, because that means every parent's got to be notified. How you guarantee that every note you send home gets given to a parent is a little bit beyond me. And we have language differences. We have access to technology differences. And everybody has email. Not everybody, reads English. There's more than one language than Spanish. We'd prefer the opt-out system. This is about whether or not you can put a nasal swab on the inside of two nostrils for a total of 15 seconds and then put that swab inside a reader and determine within 15 minutes whether or not the person has COVID or not. If it comes back negative, they have very high accuracy for negative. Positive tests are a little less accurate. So if somebody gets a positive, we would have a positive PCR test. I hope we're trying to get those lined up as well. So you could give the person another swab test for the PCR test, and that would take a couple of days to get back. But we should be able to get this down really neatly. The opt-in program is going to be a problem, because unless the parent responds, we can't give a kid a test, at least as we interpret the guidance right now. And I'm going to ask the state to either make a policy of opt-out as the default policy, or allow local jurisdictions to decide opt-in or opt-out based on their situation. We're the largest school system in Maryland. We've got 165,000 kids. We've got elementary schools that, approach 800 or 900 kids, and the high school over 3,000. We don't have the luxury of an opt-in system. We need to be able to test people and make sure we get control of the virus as quickly as possible.
When are you
and going to quarantine as few people as possible?
When are you going to ask the state about the opt-out process?
I'm going to make a request tomorrow, see if we can get some traction with it. I know the school system is considering changing the policy. That'll be up to the school board. But it's really important that we have the most effective possible policy. I mean, parents of a kid who we think is positive is sure going to want the certainty that it's a real positive and not a false positive. And when parents of children who aren't sick know that there are cases that, you know, have been tested positive, they're going to be very concerned about what kind of contacts occurred before we knew that a child was positive. So we'd like to resolve those issues as quickly as humanly possible.
And this is for students who are under the age or under the grades of sixth grade and under?
This is the biggest problem, because no one in that group, unless they're 12 years old, has been vaccinated. So until the federal guidelines allow us to vaccinate down to five-year-olds, this is a large portion. You know, it's six out of 13 of our grades are kids who are largely not vaccinated. Whereas in the high school, middle school, we probably have pretty high vaccination rates.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are talking to Mark Elrich. He is the county executive for Montgomery County, Maryland. If you have a comment, if you have a question, give us a call. We're talking about all things Montgomery County. Give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Since we are talking about this health issue, of course, it is surprising to a lot of people that Dr. Travis Gales has resigned and is planning on taking a position in San Francisco. So was it a surprise to you when he told you that he was going to be leaving?
It was a surprise. I could say that I'm not totally surprised. He really took a beating from people over the last year. I mean, he was subject and victim of, some of the worst racial slurs, homophobic crap from people. They, of course, obviously has nothing to do with anything. He worked for me, but he's a dual appointment of me and the governor. And he and I aligned, and I supported pretty much everything he did and told him that whatever he gave me for guidance, I would follow. But his other boss, and that would be the governor, and his staff had different ideas, obviously, than Montgomery County did. And it put him in a really difficult position to be a health officer and be at odds with the health department of the state, cannot have been fun. And then to endure the kind of, racial and, homophobic assaults that he endured probably made this job a lot less fun and rewarding than it should have been. When you're out there trying to save people's lives, making decisions that obviously worked. I mean, I look at Montgomery County's numbers and, his guidance gave me the confidence to, promote the orders that we did. And there aren't other places in the country that have numbers. We have the highest vaccinated population of any county over 300,000 people. And he deserves an enormous amount of credit for getting us there. And if you looked at the kind of nonsense he put up with, I wouldn't feel terribly appreciated. So I get that this wears on people. I know that, COVID has caused lots of people to resign and make different job choices. And I think he's, partly a casualty of that. But he was a great leader.
Any idea who will replace him?
No, we've started the search. As soon as he told us, that he was leaving, we began the process of creating, the job description. We're getting lots of actually applicants, many of them local right now. We expect to see a lot more. I think we'll be able to find somebody, but, the state secretary talked to me and he wanted to have some involvement in the process. And since they're going to have to approve him as well, I understand that. But I told them, what I was looking for was someone like Dr. Gales. If anybody I interview has to be willing to stand up to the state if they disagree with the state, and they have to be willing to issue orders that support their best judgment about public health, not political decisions, not by me, not by any county executive, and not political decisions of a governor. And I told the secretary that's what I was who I would be hiring.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. April calling from Maryland. Thanks for calling, April. What's on your mind?
I just wanted to make a comment.
Real quick. Go right ahead, please.
Yeah, I don't think that we should have allowed the kids to go back to school this soon. I think it should have remained virtual. To give the schools a leeway to test kids for COVID and all of these other mandates that they want to push, it's putting too much control into the school's hands versus the doctors. I do feel that it was a little too soon, and so I just want to comment on that because I live in Montgomery County. I don't think the schools should have that flexibility.
Do you have children, April?
Absolutely.
Are they in the school system now? Or?
They are in the school system, and I'm not too keen on the schools taking the responsibility of testing out of the hands of the doctors. So I think they should have just remained virtual if they were more. I think they should have remained virtual for a little while longer.
Mm-hmm.
That way,
Mr. County Executive, I'll give you about 30 seconds to respond before the break.
So the direction to test is actually coming from the medical professionals. So it's not a school decision. It's really Dr. Gales and other medical professionals who are doing this. It is going to be done by the nurses that are actually county employees that are in the school system. So the testing will be done by professionals. But this testing is really easy. It's a non-invasive swab. Well, the state calls it invasive, but it's a swab of two nostrils that then goes into a test kit. I think everybody agrees that virtual learning was not very successful and, frankly, was disproportionately unsuccessful in minority communities. Some of that having to do with technology access. And so getting back to school was generally viewed as the best thing to do educationally for children. I feel pretty good about the vaccine levels in the kids and the grades from 6 and up. And hopefully by the end of this calendar year, we'll have a solution to testing for the younger kids. But I understand the concern. There are parents who would rather be virtual right now. She's not the only one.
April, thank you so much for your comment. We need to take a break, but don't forget you can hear every edition of the Daily Drum Inside segment via podcast on WHUR.com and download the 96.3 HD2 app on your smartphone and hear the program live in its entirety. I'm Harold Fisher. John Mons is next with the original Quiet Storm on WHUR. Still taking your phone calls at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We'll be back in a few seconds. Welcome back to the Daily Drum on Sirius XM, channel 141, 96.3 HD2, and 98.3 FM. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight we are talking to Montgomery County Executive Mark Elrich about all things happening in the county. If you have a comment or a question, lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. I do want to continue with some COVID issues. One of the things that you were just talking about, you were talking about your vaccination numbers. I want to talk about one thing in particular. You're saying you're in the numbers that we received from your office, African-American vaccination rates are only 4 percentage points behind the vaccination rates of whites. And the gap, according to your office, 20 percentage points between on last May was 20 percentage points between a white and black vaccination rates. To what do you attribute that, and why have things been so successful in Montgomery County when we have seen other parts of the state struggle? Prince George's County has seen some great strides, of course. Baltimore still seeing some struggles, of course.
So I think a couple of things are part of it. One was our messaging was always consistent. in terms of we were going to be serious and we were going to be strict and we were going to protect human health. And so I think residents came to recognize that what we were doing was aimed at human health. And then we were able to, for a very long time now, point to our numbers in Montgomery County compared to numbers in the rest of the state, in the rest of the region, and around the country, and say, you know, what we're doing is actually making a difference. We are saving lives in Montgomery County. Back in the spring when, you know, things caught on fire again, you know, for example, for, you know, much of that time, Montgomery County had the lowest cases per 100,000 of any jurisdiction over 700,000 people east of the Mississippi River. And so when you can show people that what we've been doing made a difference, I think that bought us a higher level of trust than other people had. And we were very consistent in messaging. The other thing we did that, you know, particularly affected minority communities differently was we knew back when we were doing testing that we were just not getting the testing numbers from either the Black community or from the Hispanic community that we needed to get. And traditionally, you know, everything flows to the government. You know, we have our Health and Human Services. We have lots of hardworking people there. We put out lots of messages. Not all our messages get through. Not all people pay attention to government media. Not everybody trusts the government. We know all that. And when we saw what was happening, we made a kind of fundamental decision to shift a bunch of this work, the community work, over to community groups and let them help set up clinics in places where they thought clinics would be most effective, let them help drive some of the messaging so that the messaging was more effectively heard in their community. So we did a lot that was not traditional for the county in terms of empowering community groups to do this kind of work in conjunction with Health and Human Services. And I think that made a big difference because if people hear from a trusted voice, that for a lot of people makes a lot of difference than hearing from a government voice. And I think in the Hispanic community, you've got the historic unease with governments that comes with immigrants who were victims of any of the Central American governments and dictators that we propped up for, you know, almost a century. And in the African-American community, it's just this fundamental distrust of medicine here, which is, you know, really, you know, I mean, the stories you read about either minimizing people's symptoms, not paying attention to communities, the underlying conditions that exist in the African-American community. There's been a lot of time spent in developing this level of distrust, and it doesn't go away easily. And so having somebody from that community talk about the importance of getting tested helped make a big difference. And so I always thank our community partners because they were able to amplify our work. And one of the results is that going forward, we're keeping these hubs we created alive, and we're going to continue to amplify our efforts as a government through community groups in the community so that we can maintain this deeper reach. I mean, it's bigger than COVID. I mean, disparities in this county were kind of laid bare they were laid bare for some people, I should say. Some people were surprised to learn how disparate these problems are, but the truth is, there was nothing to be surprised about. But there are a lot of other issues that we need better communication with our community. And I think what we learned from this is we've got a better way to do it than simply relying on us.
Okay. Tiffany, calling from Maryland. Thanks for calling, Tiffany. What's on your mind?
Am I on the air?
Yes, you most certainly are. Go right ahead, please.
Okay. No, I was just wondering if there was going to be testing within the schools throughout the whole state.
It's an option. You know, we talked about that today. Not everybody's doing what we're doing. And so, you know, when we've got these tests, everybody who shows up in the health room with symptoms is going to get a test. We're hoping that other people do this. I mean, this is the best way to be sure that the person who's got sniffles either really has only the sniffles and everybody else can relax, or whether somebody's got COVID and you need to start, you know, checking contacts. I mean, we know that this thing can spread undetected, and the quicker we identify people carrying it and we identify people who may become infected because they were in contact, the quicker it is for us to be able to get control over the spread. I wish everybody would do it. This is not rocket science, and the test kits are cheap.
everybody does, because with school going back, like my niece, for example, she suffers from migraines. So they say that that is a COVID symptom.
Yep.
They want to send her home. They want to have her tested. So that takes away from school. That takes away from my work. And when it could be something as simple as a 15-minute test in the nurse's office.
And that's what we're going to have.
I'm sorry.
That is exactly what we're going to have, and it'll either be that by the end of this week or the beginning of next week.
Yeah, I hope they do.
We've already got the tests, so we just have to distribute them now.
Right. I hope they do it within the state, because I'm one within the whole state. I know this is about Montgomery County, but I'm in Dorchester County on the Eastern Shore.
Mm.
Yeah. Well, it is a whole state problem, because we all travel.
Yeah.
You know, and so if it's not done everywhere, then it winds up, you know, coming back to bite us. And plus, this thing mutates. I think that's what the public doesn't understand, is the rate of mutation of this virus is pretty rapid. And, you know, what we're trying to avoid are mutations that are more evasive of the vaccines. And the last thing we want is something that's flat out able to avoid vaccine protection. So it's important, not just for the immediate time, but in the long term, to make sure we can get testing and get this under better control.
And you know, to that point, Mr. County Executive, and to Tiffany as well, I mean, we've been hearing so much about the Delta variant, but, you know, there is also the Lambda variant, and now there are discussions about the Mu variant. And I'm not a physician, but certainly this appears that just as we have different strains of the flu, that we could have the different strains of COVID. I mean, it is the entire Greek alphabet.
Yep.
that may lie before us as we continue to tackle this problem. So, Tiffany, thank you so much.
It's important. It's really important that people, I think, accept the level of patience on this. You know, my biggest concern is when somebody tests, or when it looks like this is over, like in the, you know, a mere two months ago, when I had four cases a day, and I'm up to in the 150s now. When we were down there and everybody's thinking this is over, and I kept telling people, we're watching the Delta variant, we're going to see where it goes. And we were right. There was a good reason to watch the Delta variant. And I don't want people going through a series of highs and lows. Like, we could get this Delta variant almost knocked out. But you know, Lambda's in Florida. We know Mu's in 49 states now. We've got to be constantly aware that we may be called upon to do these things again in order to make sure that we can keep everybody safe. So we may have to be patient for a long time. And I don't want people going through these, you know, mood swings of elation and depression. I think it'd be better to just be wary all the time.
Tiffany, thank you so much for your phone call. I want to talk about another issue regarding school. The old news, obviously, is that school resource officers were removed from the schools, but now they're called community engagement officers. What's the difference?
Huge difference. You know, community resources, you know, the school resource officers in the past were used to enforce school discipline. Almost all the use of police, ironically, was not by police self-initiation, but was actually by requests from the administration. And most of it was for things related to violation of school rules. And so not only aren't the police going to be stationed in the school, but the police are only going to be used for things that are outside of school rules. So a principal cannot call somebody there because the student has violated the school rule and, you know, they're being difficult about it. They're going to have to be called there because there's some greater need than the enforcement of a school rule. And I think that's important. I think people were afraid that they'd simply be outside the school but used the same way. And they are not going to be sitting outside the school. They're going to be driving around, you know, throughout the cluster, which is a pretty large geographic area that includes the high school, the middle schools, and the elementary schools. And they're not going to be walking around any of those schools. They're not going to be in the elementary schools or in the middle schools. as some people are suggesting, they're basically going to be available, and they'll probably be used for other things like pedestrian safety, which is a big issue in the county, and we could use additional people making sure that folks, you know, stop for people in crosswalks and don't put our pedestrians in danger. So I think people, when they understand and when they probably, the proof will be in the use, because you can tell people anything, but they won't believe it until they see it. And I think when they realize that the police are not being dragged in to enforce school rules, I think people are going to be happy with this.
I want to talk to you also about, first of all, this incident that happened back in July of this young man who was shot and killed in the drive-through in McDonald's. And I have several questions about that, because we've seen similar incidents where we've seen a similar incident here in the District of Columbia, where officers who approached a car, one officer says a gun was spotted, and we ended up with a dead driver. I know this is still in process, but are you satisfied, based on what you've seen with this video, with what happened that night?
Well, you put me in a hard thing, because this is being investigated right now. I'll just say I'm not altogether happy with what happened last night. I don't believe that thing had to end that way. I think, you know, I will venture that what you're going to see is that we know that under the law, if an officer feels they're threatened, that they have a right to shoot. And that officers who, you know, clearly could have been in the line of fire of the person in the car, they knew he had a gun in the car, because an officer saw it, and he knew it was a Glock, and it had a magazine in it. But when Mr. LaRue finally sits up, his arm extends out, and the officers, you know, say they believe there was a gun. I mean, you hear the word gun. I don't honestly know what was in his hand at that point. And if people had not been, you know, if people had felt safe, there would not have been a reason necessarily to fire at that point. But officers were clearly, you know, standing in places where if somebody did have a gun, they should have been shot. So I can, you know, we are going to look at this in terms of how we change the way we handle a situation like that. You know, there's the whole issue of, you know, should the person, the negotiator have gotten there sooner? Should we have called in a crisis intervention team? They don't normally do that when a gun's involved. But what else could we have done that could have avoided that? Obviously, you know, Mr. LaRue was not looking for a confrontation when the officer approached the car and the gun was in the seat next to him. He didn't make any movement toward the gun. You know, nothing happened for an entire half hour. And I think it's, you know, it's tragic. I'm sure that when the ruling comes out there, people will not necessarily be happy with it. And we've just got to figure out, what do you do so that you buy enough time for things to play out, not necessarily this way.
Do you have any thoughts on the changing of de-escalation policies? This is certainly not a Montgomery County issue. This is something that police departments are constantly looking at, particularly when you have a tragic high-profile incident such as this.
Yeah, so we've, you know, contracted with ELE 4A, which is it's a consulting group that focuses on helping departments change their policies and practices. They have, you know, talked with us about, you know, de-escalation, and I believe it doesn't, you know, we don't do enough of it, that, you know, training is more heavily geared toward the use of a weapon than toward de-escalation policy. there are a lot of things that, you know, I could go into, but I won't, about what, you know, I think ought to be different, but I'm going to make them different. We're going to get the report. I fully intend to implement the bulk of the changes that are being recommended, because I think they'll give us a better police department. They will not put people at risk, but hopefully they will give our officers the time, the tools they need to make decisions that allow people to have more time and allow more intervention from mental health professionals and others before you ever get to the point that you have to make a split-second decision about whether you fire a gun or not. I think that's a common theme to almost everybody who's been shot, is that at some point an officer got to, this is life and death, this is, I have to make this decision. And every time I look at these things, I'm thinking, you know, and leading up to it, what could have been done differently that wouldn't have put that person in the situation of having to make a life and death decision. And I am determined that, you know, once the report's done, we're actually working with them now on follow-up, and I've asked for very clear guidelines that can be implemented. I didn't want a report that says you could do better, because I think we all know we could do better. I want a report that says this is what you need to do to be sure you do better. Mm.
So let's talk about roads real quick. I know this is a painful thing. I mean, just to be quite honest, talking about it this has been a long-standing thing for Montgomery County residents. You know, if you for a lot of people in Montgomery County, if you go to a dictionary and you look up the word pain, you will see you'll see I-270.
Yeah,
that's what you see. You know, this has been a problem since the Sidney Kramer, Neil Potter days of the 1990s. If you know,
showing your age, man.
absolutely, and. And so I, you know, it gives me something to compare it. And, you know, obviously you're not happy with that. You know, these improvement widening issues for I-270, you know, I-495. I look at the intercounty connector. It's a beautiful highway. The handful of times that I've used it, I keep thinking about Clint Eastwood and tumbleweeds. You know, it's... Maybe I've not used it during rush hour, so I don't know what it's like during rush hour.
No, there is no rush hour.
You know, so what are your thoughts on the widening or improvement? Let's start with just I-270.
So, yeah, look, this was something we probably could have solved. I think there is universal agreement that we needed to do something, and that this would not solely be solved by transit, much as I love transit and think they need to build it, and that the train to the western part of Maryland ought to get the second track so that it could be run bidirectionally all day long. There are a lot of things you could do that would make transit alternatives better and relieve some of the load on that road, but that road is pretty substantially beyond the point of congestion in places where there's going to be a simple, you know, transit solution. But having said that, that road is congested southbound in the morning and it's congested northbound in the evening. If they had put in two reversible lanes, they could have had their two lanes in the morning going south and the two lanes in the evening going north, and it would have effectively dealt with the bottlenecks, and it would have saved taxpayers a boatload of money or reduced the amount of money they're going to have to spend on tolls. The governor seems to be insistent on building the most expensive project to solve the problem that he can possibly design. And that is one of the problems. And I will say that throughout this, I'm the one that suggested they start at the American Legion Bridge. That was not in the governor's plan. And I said, you do not start fixing a bottleneck at the back of the bottleneck. You go to the front of the bottleneck. So the governor did that. We suggested using the ICC to get traffic off of the Beltway by bringing it across the 270 to these lanes they were going to put in, and keep them from going around the Beltway. The governor eventually agreed to do that. And we were able to show, because I know how to use Google Maps and the ruler on there, that there was enough room within the built environment to basically put in two reversible lamps. And it would have been an easy thing for them to do. Now, they opted for four, so they're going to get maybe 2 to 3 hours use out of the toll lanes going south in the morning and 2 to 3 hours use out of the toll lanes going north. And for 21 hours a day, the toll lanes won't be necessary. That seems to me an extraordinary waste of money. But here's where, you know, what really irritates me is the governor sells this as from Frederick to the American Legion Bridge. He doesn't tell you that his contract with the Australian company ends at the ICC, and that their own study says that if you ended at the ICC northbound in the evening, it's going to be far worse than it is today because you're going to condense all that traffic into two fewer lanes than you have when you take out the after you take out the toll lanes. So if you're coming from Frederick, you're coming from Clarksburg or Germantown or Gaithersburg, you're going to be in hell until you get past the ICC. And if he had done this right, which is what I asked them to do, was to design and build from Frederick to the American Legion Bridge. Do it with reversibles, but make sure you include northern Montgomery County and Frederick. Otherwise, those people are going to be stuck in what he likes to call soul-crushing traffic. And they got sold this bill of goods because people don't realize that what was done at COG is simply approving a plan. People thought approving the plan was going to result in the actual approval of a project. Well, the governor's project doesn't include half of what's in that plan. That's a major, major problem. So we're going to keep pushing. I believe, and I've Googled the map from Frederick all the way down to the ICC, that they could add a lane tomorrow, mostly by just including the inside service lane, which they're going to take out anyway. And that would give them a lane. There are a couple of places they'd actually have to put some pavement in, but there's a solution there. Our solution was less expensive. It would mean lower tolls. And then there's the whole issues that the state legislature reviewed about not having reviewed the contract, the governor keeping the comptroller from getting the money she needed to review the contract, the state oversight committee never looking at the options or whether this had to be built as a toll road or could the state finance it itself, which I believe is probably could have been done. All these other possibilities the governor refused to explore. So from my vantage point, it looks like the governor was not interested in solving a transportation problem. He was most interested in saying he built the biggest P3 project in the country and the cost to Maryland taxpayers and drivers be damned. That's my take on it.
But then is there room for improvement for 495?
There's room there. I mean, the last time I met with the secretary, and I will say, you know, I continued to talk to the secretary. So why the governor thinks we were saying no when we were always saying yes, but let's look at the design issues. I suggested two ways they could deal with that portion of the beltway that would make sure it stayed out of the environmentally sensitive areas and also out of neighborhoods. And he actually said to me the two things I suggested were part of other companies' proposals, which means that the other companies thought that these were valid construction techniques and would work to address the problem as well. So why he's not opting for things that he knows could minimize the pain and still accomplish what he wants to do, which is, you know, build it continuously to the bridge and then go across the bridge. I don't know why we're arguing about things like that. They're given an option that's less invasive, less expensive potentially. Why wouldn't you take it? And that's one of the frustrating things about dealing. And I don't blame the secretary. The secretary has a boss. He does what the boss says. But I thought, you know, in my dealings with them, that we had made a lot of progress. And if we had had more time to negotiate, we probably could have made more progress. And I thought that, you know, when the council undercut us, all the other jurisdictions were like, well, you know, if the council's okay with this, that means you've made progress. And of course, now the council, now that they've done it, they realize, I think, actually didn't get anything. And there are still these outstanding questions about the financing, which now the governor doesn't have to answer. So I feel good with where we were. I wish this had ended a little bit better. But he still has to get through two local planning departments and then he has to get through environmental review, and I don't think he's going to manage all that while he's still governor.
Real quick, in the last couple of minutes that we have here, the rental relief money, this money is coming down from the state to prevent evictions, and this is particularly important because the moratoriums of the moratoriums have ended. Is that working? Is it streamlined enough? Are people understanding it? Next week we plan on talking to the Deputy Secretary of Housing from the state. From your perspective, is it working?
So I think it's working. I think the federal government put a bunch of conditions on it that made it harder than it should have been. For example, we have to know if somebody received financial assistance from the state or the federal government. We don't have those records. That's a problem. For a while, we weren't allowed to issue letters of intent to finance rather than unless we were already ready to approve the financing. And now there have been some changes they made last week. I think they're going to speed this up. So now we'll be able to process people and we'll be allowed to allow landlords to submit batches of residents. They still have to collect the information, but they can collect the information. The tenants have to sign a waiver saying the landlords can apply. But it'll allow us to not only look at a batch of people, but it'll also let us send out a letter of intent to fund, which will obligate our funds, which is what the state wants, what the feds want. But it'll also mean that the landlords can relax and they don't have to evict the people. So we've given out $24 million of this money, and the feds want us to have $38 million given out by the end of September. We've been doing about, recently we've gotten up around $2 million a day. So if we can stay between $1 and $2 million a day for the rest of the month, we will reach the federal guidelines. And, you know, in comparison, there are jurisdictions that haven't even given out money yet, and there are jurisdictions that are way behind. Our people were cautious. I think some people would say overly cautious because they've not wanted to make decisions that might allow the federal government to claw back the money.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's not going to be forgiveness later. There's going to be, I'd settle for forgiveness, but if it's clawback, that's not a good thing. But I think we'll reach we'll reach the federal goals. I think we'll be okay.
Okay.
It's still not enough money.
All right.
You know, not enough money total. Even if I give it all out, more people will not have gotten aid than got aid.
Montgomery County Executive Mark Elrich, thank you so much for your time. We'll be talking again soon.
Yeah, thank you as always.
All right. That is the Daily Drum for this Tuesday, September 7th. I'm Harold Fisher. Good night.